Saxophonist Ivo Perlman and trumpeter Nate Woolley. It comes from the album Polarity, which I am very excited to announce is one of the first releases on the Burning Ambulance Music label, which we launched in October with a compilation, and which will be getting going in earnest next year. Polarity will be available in February, but you can pre-order it now at burningambulancemusic.bandcamp.com. It's $13 for the CD plus shipping, or $10 for the download. And Ivo Perlman is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Network. This is episode 61, and our final episode of 2020, which has been, frankly, a horrible year for a lot of people. We've lost a lot of important jazz musicians and musical figures. Venues have gone under. Live music in general has basically vanished. It's been rough all around. So I hope this podcast and the articles on the website have been of some interest to you throughout the year, giving you something to listen to while locked away in isolation or quarantine or whatever. Because as terrible as it's been in a lot of ways, 2020 was also Burning Ambulance's 10th anniversary year. We started at the beginning of 2010, and we have a lot of plans for 2021 and beyond. So if you do enjoy the show or the website, I hope you will consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to keep things going and create more and better content in 2021 and into the future. So please become a subscriber if you can. Okay, Ivo Perlman, I've known about him for about 25 years. The first record of his I heard was Cama de Terra, which came out in 1996. And it was actually notable because it was the very last release on Homestead Records, right before Stephen Jorg, who was the head of the label at that time, left and started On Fidelity. That album featured Pearlman with Matthew Shipp on piano and William Parker on bass, and they're two of the people he's continued to work with ever since, along with many others, including Joe Morris, Nate Woolley, Matt Maneri, Whit Dickey, and a whole slew of other players. See, Evo's discography is massive. He puts out albums in bunches, sometimes as many as 8 at a time, sometimes 3 and even 4 CD sets. He just recently passed the 100 release mark, which puts him in pretty rarefied company, up there with Duke Ellington, Anthony Braxton, David Murray, and very few others. It can be hard to know where to even begin with his catalog, frankly, but his music has evolved a lot over time. He's really on a lifelong creative journey, which is why he's constantly collaborating with people in new combinations and changing his approach to the horn, sometimes quite radically, and just generally trying new things. He's one of the most open musicians you'll ever come across. So you're probably best off, if you're new to his work, you're probably best off starting with something recent and then moving backwards, kind of deciding what to listen to based on who's on a given record. He's been living in Brooklyn for many years, but he's originally from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and when the pandemic got rolling really badly in the summer, he went back to Brazil, which was where we connected for this interview. It was conducted via Skype, so there are a few points at which the sound warps a little or cuts in and out, but still, I'm sure you will be able to figure out what he's saying in those moments. We had a really fascinating conversation, I think. It's all about his creative philosophy and his practice regimen and the role of improvisation in Brazilian music and a lot of other things. I hope you'll enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed having it. Before I roll the interview, though, I'm going to play one more piece of music, as I always do. As I mentioned, Evo puts out a lot of records, and he's got another one coming out in January on the Dow Forms label, which is run by Whit Dickey. It's called Garden of Jewels, and it features him, Whit, and Matt Shipp. So I'm going to play a little bit of the title track, and after that you'll hear my conversation with Evo Pearlman.
Thank you. We've never actually spoken, you and I. We've exchanged emails and stuff like that, but we've never actually, like, talked. So.
Never, never. I didn't know if you were short, tall, blonde, bald. No idea.
Yeah, yeah. So.
So how so long you look you look younger than me. You know, actually everybody is looking younger than me. I'm turning 60 now. I'm looking at the world now like, oh, you know what? My dentist, my lawyer, my girlfriend, even my grandfather looks younger than me. I don't know.
I'm going to be 49 next week, but I don't look it. Right. So.
You're a baby. You look like a baby. You're a baby. All right.
So how long have you been down in Brazil?
Pretty much almost 6 months now. When the pandemic hit hard in New York, after the recording, I made plans to leave, and I did not leave earlier because there were no flights available. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I got on a flight, I left. But I am due back soon. I'm itching to go back and do work and recordings and all that. But yeah.
So you've been down there since like June, July then? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So because I guess then you got to see the whole pandemic unfold in Brazil. So how did it go there? Did you feel safe?
No, when I got here, it was at the peak of the infection, and it was people were saying you shouldn't go there. It's much worse than the States. And then the States got pretty bad all over, and here they experimenting a break, and now like everywhere else in the whole world is coming back full force, unfortunately, you know.
Yeah, I've been watching, the Scandinavian countries. I mean, I saw what Sweden tried to do just to sort of like roll through it, and it didn't work for them at all, you know, because I've been out there. I've been to Sweden, Norway, Finland, you know, so I've been watching, you know, to see mm-hmm. what the story is. And they got hit pretty, you know, proportionally pretty hard because there's not that many people, you know, not like the States or Brazil, you know.
I think there's two parameters in this whole story: bugs and human beings. However you want to slice it, they're gonna hit us. I mean, mask, no mask, whatever.
So there's a bunch of things I want to ask you about your music, because I feel like you're a really unique figure, you know. So mm-hmm. I've read that you were initially inspired by like Stan Getz and Paul Desmond and players like that. And I feel like I can still hear that in your playing, even in the freer stuff. So can you talk a little bit about that kind of interest in the beautiful side of things?
Sure. I'll give it to you straight. I am very influenced by the music that I heard as a kid, growing up. And that was Brazilian pop music that's very lyrical and it's very romantic. In fact, that's what I thought I was going to be doing: music, writing and singing my own material, vocals. I was a guitar player, and I used to write music and lyrics and sing. And I still do in a way, but somewhere along the way, I became a saxophonist. By accident, I guess, because, you know, a friend of mine was into jazz, and I was studying the clarinet, and he hooked me up with the jazz scene, and I started listening to Wayne Shorter, Paul Desmond, Stan Getz, you know, the Bossa Nova years and all that. And then when I went to Berklee College, I was studying Sonny Rollins, bebop, everything by the book. Let's put it that way. But the thing is, when it came down to actual playing with fellow Berklee College students or sessions or jam sessions, something would happen. I would snap. I would go nuts. I just don't know. It's just who I am. I would just let it all out and forget everything that my teachers told me and the books told me and the and the syntax and the grammar and the laws and the 2-5-1s, and I would just play from my guts or something. I don't know how to put it in words. It got worse when I went to Los Angeles because the scene there is much more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And the sessions I attended, people would say, you know, what's wrong with this guy? You know, he's just making all that noise. Then I realized, you know, there were other people who would make quote-unquote noise, and I belonged to a different gang altogether. So back in New York, then when I went in New York City, then I met Fred Hopkins, Matthew Shipp, William Parker, Andrew Surreal, people like that. And I said, you know what, that's where I belong, and this is who I am. Deep down, I'm a romantic at heart. I'm a Brazilian singer at heart. Deep down, that's all I'm doing. Especially now, because the 6 months here, I've been intensely, methodically studying the bel canto. You know what the bel canto is?
A little bit, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that started with Maria Callas when I was injured. My larynx got injured from over-practicing the altissimo. So people told me, you should study opera and have a strong connection because you relax your larynx and all that. So I did, but now here in Brazil, I got a bunch of books from the bel canto area, and I've been crazily methodically studying it, and the saxophone really is turning into a whole new thing. I just told Matthew Shipp, when I'm back to New York, we're going to start a whole new chapter. Better forget everything we did. I feel like a new musician. I mean, I just opened up the whole register, the whole singing, the whole air column in the saxophone, the whole reed feeling in the mouth. It turned loose. It's vibrating. I really hit the spot. So now I can become the singer that I always was.
Something I feel like I read that you went through a similar change a few years ago in your style, that something you had some kind of an issue where you changed your whole approach to the horn. Was that the last one?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the thing. I know I was practicing the overtones, and my larynx and my throat area was too uptight. And when you practice up there, you know, then you really, you're like, you, what's the word in English? It's a big risk. Mm-hmm. So I started bleeding. I started actually bleeding. I went to a doctor and said, you know what, you got to do something about it because you won't go far if you keep doing what you're doing. So I started to study opera singing, and I started to relax my whole larynx and work from the diaphragm really intensely and practice Maria Callas arias, and I end up recording a whole album dedicated to Callas,
mm-hmm,
with Matthew Shipp. And now is the second, maybe final chapter of this book. Like I zoom in very strong into that operatic method, and that's what's happening right now. And it's a continuation, an aftermath of what you just described that happened some 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, people don't think a lot about the physical aspect of playing the horn, but I mean, I interviewed Peter Breutzmann, and he told me, well, number one, there's the legend that one time he broke a rib playing because he was blowing so hard, but there was also, he said that, you know, recently he went to the doctor, and he has like a condition in his lungs from all the years of playing so hard and forcefully and stuff, and like he has the lungs of basically someone who like works as a glass blower, you know.
Wow.
So
it's a strong lungs.
But it's like he has a condition now, so he can't play as much as he used to because he's like blown his lungs out like a glass blower does, you know, from all the heat and energy and everything. It's pretty, it's pretty crazy, the physical results of all the work, you know. People don't think about it as physical work.
Spirit and matter can't escape that dichotomy, and it's an inner condition of being alive. We materialized energy. If you don't know what you're doing, and you do it with all your passion, you're going to end up hurt, you know?
Yeah.
No two ways about it.
Yeah. So there doesn't seem to be a tradition of improvisation in Brazilian music similar to the free jazz tradition in North America. Like there, I'm sure there is a role for improvisation in Brazilian music, but it's different. So, I mean, what is it in your mind? Like, how do you see it?
Yeah, I like the way you put it. There is a role for improvisation in Brazilian music, particularly in a style called choro. Choro, I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a very instrumental-like music, and their basic 8th note is the 16th note with a light samba feeling in the background. And the instrumentalist, the flutist, the saxophonist, they play beautiful melodies with lots of chord tones, much like bebop, and some passing tones. There's a resemblance to bebop.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is even more round and romantic and inside. But it's very pleasant and very hip, very, very, very hip. And within that genre, there is some improvisation. They never deliver the melody always the same way. They're always embellishing it. Embellishing so much that you can say they're improvising it. But it's nothing like jazz. Nothing like jazz, absolutely. I went for the jugular. I went for the core of jazz, the matrix, where, you know, where it's born, when jazz is born. The pure creativity, you know. I went from Brazilian music to free jazz, much like Steve Lacy went from Dixieland to free jazz, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could draw a parallel maybe, you know, in that regard, but no, there, we don't have a tradition like jazz. Improvisation is not big here. The maximum I would say is this style called choro that allows for ample improvisation, but within a lot of parameters, you know, that does not resemble jazz at all.
It kind of sounds like sort of the way you would describe bluegrass music up here, where it's like it's a folk form, and there's room for improvisation, but it has to be constrained, you know, within the song form at the same time.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. You could say that all the way, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a famous quote that always stuck in my head, and I forget exactly who said it, but it was a country singer talking about a guitar player, and he said, yeah, that guy soloed himself right out of a job. You know, because he was like, he was a brilliant, you know, soloist, but it was like too much, you know, too much for country.
Oh, I got you. Okay, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, you know, people resist the pure creativity. It's scary, you know. It's scary. Usually people need directives, they need an agenda, a schedule. It turns them anxious, you know. They have to face the sheer reality of life, that we are nothing. We came from nothing. We go nowhere. You know, I mean, no matter how anal, retentive and control like you want to be, we have absolutely no control on anything. I mean, case in point, this pandemia, you know. Mm-hmm. 2012, men have been to the moon, and we know so much, so technology savvy, and all of a sudden we are stuck, you know, by a small thing that is even dead. It's like protein coated by some fat structure. I don't know how. You know, it's not even alive, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's stopping in our trails. You know, we are stuck. You know, we have no control. And free jazz just drives people crazy, insane. They don't want to deal with free jazz creative people because we scare them. Because we focus, we shine a light on the unknown, on the unpredictable. You know, people get scared.
Yeah, yeah. For a long time, you had a fairly exclusive relationship with Leo Records. They put out a tremendous amount of your CDs. Tell me about how that relationship developed and how it was sustained, because it's very rare for an artist to get that kind of buy-in from a label. you know, for a label to be like, I'm on the path with you, whatever you, you know, whatever you're doing, we're in.
Yeah. Sure. Well, basically, I dig Leo and Leo digs me. We got along fine. When I met him, I found him to be a very interesting man, a Russian emigre living in the UK, who kept his vodka with Russian herbs in the freezer. You know, I found that so hip. You know, he had me for dinner. I met his wife then. I thought that his label was still very hip, with many titles that from very interesting musicians. And I really wanted to be there. And as I started to develop my language, I think he realized that, you know, I mean business. I really mean business. I mean, I'm on a path of self-discovery and building up a language. And he appreciates that. He could see that, you know, I will not stop till I'm dead. I have something that I'm going after musically. And I think he appreciates that. And he understood that the thing about my work process is to be able to record and go to the next level without much further ado, without preparation. Just go to the studio, record, analyze, see what happened, grow from it, and go to the next, and go to the next, and go to the next. So we got onto a very nice relationship, absolutely.
You you record in a lot of sort of unorthodox combinations of instruments. Like it's fairly rare that you have like a standard, you know, sax, piano, bass, drums, quartet. Why do you like working in unusual lineups?
Because I like the unknown. I know what to expect if it's a traditional jazz quartet. I mean, you more or less, that's so much you can do within a jazz quartet. Not that it's not a valid, beautiful format, but I want to be surprised as much as I can whenever I walk into the studio. I know it puts me on my toes. That's I work better under extreme pressure and challenge. If I hear something unfamiliar format, group, timbres, musical styles, it does something to me, and I feel that that's where I'm gonna grow, and I don't wanna get stuck. That's why I wake up every morning. First thing I want to do is jump out of bed and practice, because it's always an opportunity to tap into the unknown, to go past of what I know. Regurgitating what I know bores me to death. You know, so that's why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is your practice regimen? Because you are so sort of committed to full improvisation in the studio. So, I mean, do you play a lot of like scales and long tones and things like that? Or do you just play for a couple of hours to kind of keep yourself active creatively? Like how do you work?
Yeah, I love your question because I think about this all the time. I'm really how do you say that in English? Dr. Jekyll and Hyde? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
My modus operandi is all or nothing, extreme opposites. When it's time to be serious and communicate and say, this is who I am musically, I totally forget scales, language, vocabulary, other musicians' influence, or at least I try to as much as I can. It's total, I would say, naturalness, organic chaos, surprise, spontaneity, childlike curiosity. But on my daily basis, I am a nut, meticulous. I study all the books, all the scales, all the styles, all the music literature of all instruments. I practice out of trumpet, trombone, flute, piano, cello, violin, viola. I like to transpose and transcribe methods from other instruments to the saxophone, because that's a real challenge, not only range-wise, but stylistically. You know, it forces you to really understand how the saxophone operates when you are forced to play on a non-saxophonist way. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, every instrument has its own natural way conducive to its mechanics. You know, it's easier to do a few things on the cello than on the flute, you know. And when you're forced to do what the cello is doing, you have to think twice about what the saxophone is like, how it functions, you know, how can you amplify its expressive capabilities. So I am a nut regarding that. I am so meticulous. I have everything written down, like how fast, how slow, what tonality. I mean, you wouldn't say, if you look at my notebooks, you wouldn't say this guy is not a free jazz musician at all. You know, he plays Bach or something. You know, I'm so meticulous. But I am totally Dr. Jekyll and Hyde. This is just one aspect. The other aspect is the total opposite of it. I just want to break free, break loose, turn crazy, and just play what I don't know. But of course, both areas communicate intensely, and it's just the same thing. But so I can keep my sanity, I divide it into two very distinct departments on my daily practice life.
I think that that's similar to something that I've heard from Cecil Taylor, where, you know, he talked about you need to be a complete master of the instrument so that when you're performing, it can just take over. You know, the music can take over and you can do anything. You know, there's nothing that's outside of your grasp creatively.
Yes, absolutely. And it's much, much more than that. It's beyond that, because you don't know what you don't, what you know. You really don't know what you know if you don't have the material means, the muscular means to execute your ideas. If, you know, you can think, but thinking it's nothing. Thinking is within you, in you. It will never reach the outside world. So you need the muscle, you need the bone, the flesh, and the blood to execute your inner musicality. And the only way to do it to the max is what you said, what Cecil Taylor said, and that I abide for. There's no limit. I mean, if you are a serious artist and you have to get it out of your system and really speak your language to the max, being a master is not enough. You have to be one with your instrument. You have to merge with your instrument, become the metal of the saxophone, learn how it vibrates molecularly. You know, you have to think like a saxophone. You have to become the metal lick that makes a saxophone. And you can only get there if you do what I do, I think. Total devotion. It's a real marriage. It's like a religious coupling with your instrument.
Yeah, and the other element is, because there are other elements of consistency in your work, like you record a lot at Park West with Jim Klaus Engineering. So
yeah,
how would you describe the sound that you like on the horn, and what does he do to kind of impact the music and also to keep the creative lines open? Like, what does he do for you when you come in for a session so that you're not impeded creatively, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I appreciate that you asked that, because I don't think I was ever asked that. Jim is a great engineer, sound engineer, excellent. He has a studio that is not in the attic. What's underneath? Attic is upstairs. Right? Well, how do you call it when it's underneath?
Like a penthouse?
Basement.
Sort of?
Basement.
Oh, basement. Okay.
Yeah, but he built it in a great way that you feel so comfortable there. But it sounds like a huge room, because he has incredible oral skills, technical oral skills, because Jim is also an accomplished great saxophonist and drummer. So he's the ideal combination of sound engineer and musician. He can edit, he can do anything. He's a musician and engineer. Plus his space is fantastic. I feel at home, and he's a great guy. We get along, and we found the system. You know, he mixes and master it right after my session. And when I hear the final product, it's ready. I don't have to second guess how much better it will sound after he mixes, because he sent to me the rough mix already mixed and mastered. So we got on a work methodology that is very efficient. So all that put together, you know, it's the ideal combination.
Mm-hmm. When you're walking into the studio the morning of a session, do you have a particular thing in mind? Like you say, I'm going to play a lot of long tones today, or I'm going to go all the way into the upper register a lot, or I'm going to let the other guy lead and be mostly reactive, you know, or do you really just start from zero and see where it goes?
Oh, please. Of course, I go to start from zero. I mean, it would be no fun to have any of those thoughts. I just know it's going to be a great day, an opportunity to be creative, and that's all I'm expecting. Anything else, I let it happen till the last minute. And even within the session, the first set, many a times, is completely different than the second set. You know, it's totally total metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm.
Metamorphosis. Total. And it took me a while to accept that, because I was trying to be in some kind of control, you know, but then I realized this type of music, and this is not who I am. I'm just going to go for it.
I feel like that would be even more challenging, because expectations are so much of human nature, you know, and when you're dealing, especially when you're dealing with art, you know, and when you're dealing with a musician that you, whose work you know, in a way, I feel like it must be really challenging to kind of push all that aside and say, I'm not going to expect this from Joe Morris, for example, even though I've heard 100 Joe Morris sessions, you know, I'm not going to expect something from him. We're going to see what happens. Like, I feel like that would be really tough.
It will be very, very tough. But we know what takes place is, I've been fortunate to live in New York City, where I met people like Joe Morris, Matthew Shipp, William Parker, Whit Dickey, Gerald Cleaver, Jason Wong. My God, there's so many that Nate Woolley, all these incredible talent improvisers. And they think more or less like I think. They are open to the unknown. They thrive on the unknown. That's what makes them. And so it's not only my reaction to it, but it's a symbiotic, synergetic process. It's the less that I know, it's the less that they know, and it's the less that the by end product will be. Our unpredictability and lack of expectation influence each other and changes the final result dramatically. And I've played with Matthew on so many sessions, I'm sure you know that, so many recordings. And the thing is, it's always fresh. He's totally unpredictable. He's unlimited. Mm-hmm. Matthew Shipp, like all the other guys I mentioned, they are unlimited in their musicianship. There's something new, something hidden in within them, itching to get out musically. So it's just a matter of being there, being healthy, being alive, and doing it. It will surface. You know?
Yeah. See, that's again something that, you know, looking at it from the outside, it feels like, when you're working with somebody for a long time, like you've been with Matt, and like a creative relationship develops, I wonder if it presents challenges in order to avoid sort of going over old ground. Like, have you ever found yourself saying, "Oh, we've done this before. We should try something else."
Sure. That can happen, but it's not perceptible to the listener, and it's barely perceptible to us because we have a built-in, thank God, modus operandi that shy away from the familiar. You know, it's like you're at a banquet. You're sitting down with a lot of food, and you go first to the yummy ones. You go to the, you're naturally gonna savor what you love first, and you want to be stuffed and satisfied with that before you have to eat the old familiar, I don't know, steak or something. I don't know, whatever. So we have that naturally built in. We don't go there. We don't go where we know we are familiar. It's not fun. Simply not fun. What's, you know, in our point of view, what's why do it again? That's the question that always is there. Why do it again? Who needs to hear it again? Not us, not you, not anybody.
How do you connect with new collaborators? Like, do people contact you about someone and say, you know, you should work with so-and-so, I think you would connect creatively? I mean, how do you find a new creative partner? Because there are people that you've made only one or two records with, and then there are people that you've made like a dozen records with, so.
Yeah, it can happen two ways. Someone like Matthew Shipp, my work with someone that I never heard or play with, for instance, Matthew told me about Gordon Grudina, the Canadian great oud player, guitar player. And, you know, I thought, you know, if Matthew worked with him, that already means something, you know. Mm-hmm. And sure thing, I heard Gordon say, man, I really want to play with this guy. And we start doing something, and we just have a new recording out. The Purity of Desire, or Not Two Records, and I love this album, and I hope to be able to do more and more with Gordon, and I can see this is going to grow. This is one way of doing. Sometimes somebody I don't know might recommend somebody, and I would listen, and the proof of the pudding is in the first hearing. The two, three first notes I hear from the person, I know if it's going to work or not. I can feel it in my bones. Mm-hmm. And but I'm very cautious with that. I usually tend to keep the same gang, the same personnel, the same group of musicians, because I know we get along in the sense that we're all open to the unknown, and they are open to grow and to tap into not so safe areas, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You do a tremendous amount of work in the studio, but you don't play out that much. Why is that?
Ask the agents and the jazz establishment. I honestly don't know. I was playing every day somewhere on Earth. Just put me on an airplane, pay me some money, and I'll be there. So ask the agents. I don't know, man. It's not... You know, I mean, I love the studio, and I love playing live too, but I guess jazz gigs, opportunities, you know, paying gigs, it's becoming harder and harder. I guess that's it. That's why, you know.
Do you feel like you're considered an outsider within the jazz scene? Because I mean, you're clearly part of the community within the sort of Vision Festival community of artists, you know, Matt and William and everybody else, but at the same time I feel like, you know, and this is probably more a question of how the jazz press perceives people than anything else, you know, but do you feel like you're seen a different way from those guys?
You know, I think that I only have one responsibility as an artist, is to understand how I see myself. If I start worrying about how other people see myself, it's gonna be tough. I mean, I have a hard enough time understanding my own inner artistic process, knowing where I am, where I came from, where I want to be, how to make sense out of all that voracious appetite for new music, for creativity. I try to keep it at that. I don't pay too much attention. I, of course, appreciate and like when I read reviews and all that, but I try not to put too much attention to that because people are people, and there are cliques, social gangs, this and that, politics, racism. Oh my God, you know what I'm talking about. So I just try to like worry less about what really does not matter.
So tell me about the duo session with Nate Woolley that I'm putting out. You had worked with him a few times before in trios and quartets and stuff like that. So what made you think that a duo would be, something to try?
I resisted the idea because he's so resourceful. Nate is so resourceful that I wanted to distill our relationship bit by bit through small combos, trios, quartets. Until the day came that I thought, I think the next step is to do it face to face with him. I'm ready. And I'm glad I did because I really love the result. And not only that, but I want to do a second or maybe a third one because he's the epitome of what I just described to you. Tapping into the unknown, being totally in the moment and in command of a wide array of resources and technical trumpet-like means. In fact, I don't think Nate Woolley is a trumpet player because he super exceeds the brass aspect of the trumpet. I actually don't hear him as a trumpet player at all. It's so artistic and so creative, and he shies away from the trumpet-like techniques. Guitar players, trumpet players, musicians, we are limited by the physical constraints of what our instruments can do. But sometimes come along Nate Woolley guy that just blows it all up. He changes the whole paradigm of trumpet playing. He's a total artist. He's not a trumpet player or just a trumpet player. When I hear him, I don't relate to it as a trumpet player, mm-hmm. not at all. It's so creative. It's the sounds, the timbres, the textures. It's beautiful. I'm very proud of that album. Very, very proud.
I think what's interesting about him is a lot of his approach creatively seems to be about challenging himself almost to the degree of putting obstacles in his own way to kind of get around them,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that. I agree with that.
And he does the same thing with people that he's collaborating with. Like, he'll put people in an unexpected situation and say, do something with this, Let's see what you've got, in a way.
I heard him respond totally different within different situations. I mean, totally different. Different Nate Woolleys. I know 10 different Nate Woolleys playing the trumpet.
So do you see I guess with a catalog the size of yours, it's kind of a document of your own development as an artist. So, given that, do you ever go back and listen to your own, previous records?
Almost never. I don't find it amusing to sit on my laurels or see where I was back then. Very rarely. I am very worried about today and tomorrow, though. That's why I just get out of bed. First thing I want to do is practice to see if I can build on what I did yesterday. So the next recording will be documented and show some growth. That's my modus operandi. I rarely listen to stuff I did. It's funny you should ask because now there's a Brazilian guy a filmmaker called Leo Costa, Leonel Costa. He just finished a documentary, a 1 hour documentary about my work. And he went back and dug material from the 80s and 90s, like old stuff that I either never heard or saw, or it's been 2-3 decades since I saw it. And then I saw it a few times, I had to, and I was like, wow, I don't even recognize myself. I mean, it's like looking at a photo of yours when you were 3 months old as a baby, you know. Mm-hmm. So this is who I was. It doesn't really relate to me, you know. I don't get a kick out of listening to what I did in the past, not at all.
So given that you've just recently passed 100 recordings, what do you think you've learned about yourself and about your music in that span of time?
Oh yeah, that's why I do it the way I do it. There's a steep learning curve, and that is what makes me tick. That excites me, that if there's anything in life besides being helping people and being helpful to your fellow humans, is that we spend 80, 90, 100 years on the earth, and we are given an opportunity to grow. And so that's my motto. And if you ask me, how do you feel you grew? Where is your growth? In what areas? You know, it changes from time to time. Right now, I am working towards getting one with the essence of the saxophone, and that's the air column. The air that is formed inside the tube of the saxophone, or any woodwind instrument for that matter, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to, of course, you know, when I blow the first air that I blew, in an instance, it's all the way out in the other end of the instrument. But it's still me, and I want to be an extension of that air column. I want to be in touch with that air column. I want to be in total control. So every subtle sound, inflection, tonguing, articulation, melodic, rhythmic, harmonic change that I want to operate is within my grasp, because I am still in command, and I am still that first molecule of air that was created at the base of the mouthpiece before the air column is formed. You know, that's a very interesting concept. It's much like the bow pressure of the violin player. It's so crucial to the quality of the sound and how the music ideas of the violin player will come across to the listener. It's all born in there. The quality of the pick of the guitar player, you know, the first mechanical originator of sound within a particular instrument. That's where it's all born. So right now I am deeply into it, and I spend 3 hours a day investigating that alone every day. It's Herculean work. It requires a lot of persistence and maturity. But, you know, I'm turning 60 in a few weeks, so I think I've earned the maturity, the patience, and the determination to follow that path. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was my conversation with Ivo Perlman, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to improve the website and the show. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.